Chapter 22. The Willed. Egwene was shocked awake as Gawain clamped his hand over her mouth. She tensed, memories returning like the light of a sunrise. They were still hiding beneath the broken cart. The air still smelled of burned wood. The land nearby was dark as coal. Night had fallen. She looked to Gawain and nodded. Had she really drifted off? She wouldn't have thought it possible under the circumstances.
"I'm going to try to slip away," Gawain whispered, "and make a distraction."
"I'll go with you."
"I can go more quietly."
"Obviously you've never tried to sneak up on someone from the Two Rivers, Gawain Trekhand," she said. "I'd bet you 100 Tarvalen marks that I'm the quieter of the two."
"Yes," Gawain whispered. "But if you draw within a dozen steps of one of their channelers, you'll be spotted, no matter how quiet. They've been patrolling through camp, particularly at the perimeters."
She frowned. How did he know that?
"You went out scouting."
"A little," he whispered. "I wasn't seen. They're scavenging through the tents, taking captive anyone they find. We won't be able to hide here much longer."
He should not have gone out without asking her.
"We..."
Gawain stiffened,
and Egwene cut off, listening. Feet, shuffling. The two of them pulled back, watching as 10 or 12 captives were led into an open space near where the command tent had stood. Sharans placed torches on poles around the ragged prisoners. A few of these were soldiers, beaten to the point where they could barely walk. There were cooks and laborers as well. They had been lashed, their trousers frayed. All of their shirts had been removed. On their backs, someone had tattooed a symbol that Egwene did not recognize. At least, she thought they were tattoos. The symbols might have been burned into them. As the captives were gathered, someone yelled nearby. In a few minutes, a dark-skinned Sharan guard walked up, dragging a young messenger boy he'd apparently found hiding in camp. He ripped off the boy's shirt and shoved him crying to the ground. The Sharans oddly wore clothing that had a large diamond shape cut out of the back. Egwene could see that the guard bore a mark on his own back, a tattoo she could barely make out against his dark skin. His clothing was very formal, with a large, stiff robe that came almost to his knees. It didn't have sleeves, but underneath he wore a shirt with a diamond cutout that had long sleeves. Another Sharan came out of the darkness, and this man was almost completely naked. He wore ripped trousers but no shirt. Instead of a tattoo on his back, he had tattoos all across his shoulders. They crept up his neck like twisted vines before reaching up to cup his jaw and cheeks. They looked like 100 twisted hands, long fingers with claws holding his head from below. This man went over to the kneeling messenger boy. The other guards shuffled. They weren't comfortable with this fellow, whoever he was. He held out a hand, sneering. The boy's back burned suddenly with a tattoo mark like that of the other captives. Smoke rose, and the boy cried out in pain. Gawain exhaled softly in shock. That man with the tattoos running up onto his face, that man could channel. Several of the guards muttered. She could almost understand the words, but they had a thick accent. The channeler snapped like a feral dog. The guards stepped back, and the channeler prowled off, disappearing into the shadows.
Light, Egwene thought.
Rustling in the darkness resolved into two women in the wide silk dresses. One had lighter skin, and as Egwene searched, she found that some of the soldiers did too. Not all Sharans were dark as the fellows she'd seen so far. The women's faces were very beautiful, delicate. Egwene shrank back. From what she had seen earlier, these two would probably be channelers. If they stepped too close to Egwene, they might sense her. The two women inspected the captives.
By the light of their lanterns, Egwene made out tattoos on their faces as well, though theirs were not as disturbing as those upon the men. These were like leaves, tattooed from the back of the neck forward, going under the ears and spreading like blossoms on the cheeks. The two women whispered to one another, and again Egwene felt as if she could almost understand them. If she could weave a thread to listen. Idiot, she thought. Channeling would get her killed here. Others gathered around the captives. Egwene held her breath. 100, 200 more people approached. They did not talk much. They seemed a quiet, solemn people, these Sharans. Most of those who came had open backs to their garments, revealing their tattoos. Were those symbols of status? She had assumed that the more important one was, the more intricate the tattoos. However, officers, she had to assume that was what they were with their feathered helmets and fine silken coats and golden armor made as if of coins that had been sewn together through the holes at their centers. They had only small openings, revealing tiny tattoos at the base of shoulders. They've removed pieces of armor to display the tattoos, she thought. Surely they did not do battle with the skin exposed. This was something done during more formal times. The last people who joined the crowd, ushered to the front, were the strangest of all. Two men and a woman atop small donkeys, all three wearing beautiful silk skirts, their animals draped with gold and silver chains. Plumes of vibrant colors fanned out from intricate headdresses upon these three. They were nude from the waist up, including the woman, save for the jewelry and necklaces that covered much of their chests. Their backs were exposed, their heads shaven just on the back to show their necks. There were no tattoos. So, lords of some sort? Except all three had hollow, haunted expressions. They slumped forward, eyes down, faces wan. Their arms seemed thin, almost skeletal, so frail. What had been done to these people? It made no sense to her. The Sharans were undoubtedly a people as baffling as the Aiel, probably more so. But why come now? Egwene thought. Why? After centuries upon centuries of isolation, have they finally decided to invade? There were no coincidences, not of this magnitude. These had come to ambush Egwene's people, and had worked with the Trollocs. She let herself seize upon that. Whatever she learned here would be of vital importance. She could not help her army right now. Light send that some of its members at least had managed to flee, so she should learn what she could. Gawain prodded her softly. She looked to him and felt his worry for her. Now? He mouthed, gesturing behind them. Perhaps with everyone's attention drawn by whatever was happening, the two of them could sneak away. They started to back up, shuffling quietly. One of the Sharan channelers called out. Egwene froze. She'd been spotted. No, no. Egwene breathed deeply, trying to calm her heart, which seemed to be trying to beat its way out through her chest. The woman was speaking to the others. Egwene thought she'd heard the words, "It is done," through the thick accent. The group of people knelt down. The bejeweled trio bowed their heads further. And then, near the captives, the air bent. Egwene couldn't describe it any other way. It warped and seemed to rip apart, twisting like it did above the road on a hot day. Something formed from this disruption. A tall man in glistening armor. He wore no helmet and had dark hair and light skin. His nose was slightly hooked, and he was very handsome, particularly in that armor. It looked to be constructed all of coins, silvery and overlapping. The coins were polished to such a shine, they reflected the faces around him like a mirror.
"You have done well,"
the man announced to those bowing before him.
You may stand.
His voice bore hints of the Sharan accent, but it was not nearly as thick. The man placed his hand on the pommel of the sword at his waist as the others rose. From the darkness behind, a group of the channelers crawled forward. They bobbed for this newcomer in a kind of bow. He removed one of his gauntlets, reached out with an offhanded gesture, and scratched the head of one of the men, as a lord might favor a hound.
So these are the new Inakal, the man said speculatively. Do any of you know who I am?
The captives cringed before him. Though the Sharans had risen, the captives were smart enough to remain on the ground. None of them spoke.
I suspected not, the man said, though one can never tell if one's fame has spread unexpectedly. Tell me, if you know who I am. Speak it, and I will let you free.
No replies.
Well, he will listen and remember, the man said. I am Bao, the Willed. I am your savior. I have crawled through the depths of sorrow and have risen up to accept my glory. I have come seeking what was taken from me. Remember that.
The captives cowered further, obviously uncertain what to do. Gawain tugged on Egwene's sleeve, motioning backward, but she did not move. There was something about that man. He looked up suddenly. He focused on the women channelers, then gazed about, peering into the darkness.
Do any of you Inakal know the dragon?
He asked, though he sounded distracted.
Speak up. Tell me.
I did see him, said one of the captive soldiers. Several times.
Did you speak with him?
Bao asked, strolling away from the captives.
No, great lord, the soldier said. The Aes Sedai, they did speak with him. Not I.
Yes, I worried you would be of no use, Bao said. Servants, we are being watched. You have not searched this camp as well as you claimed. I sense a woman nearby who can channel.
Egwene felt a spike of alarm. Gawain pulled on her arm, meaning to go, but if they ran, they'd be captured for certain. Light! She... The crowd turned at a sudden noise near one of the fallen tents. Bao raised a hand, and Egwene heard a furious yell in the darkness. Moments later, Lyanna floated through the crowd of Sharans, tied in air, her eyes wide. Bao brought her up close to him, holding her wrapped in weaves that Egwene could not see. Her heart continued to pound. Lyanna was alive. How had she remained hidden? Light! What could Egwene do?
Ah, Bao said. One of these Aes Sedai. You have spoken with the dragon.
Lyanna didn't respond. To her credit, she kept her face blank.
Impressive, Bao said, reaching up fingers and touching her chin.
He held up another hand, and the collected captives suddenly started to writhe and scream. They burst into flames, yelling in agony. Egwene had to forcibly stop herself from reaching for the true source as she watched. She was crying by the time it ended, though she did not remember starting. The Sharans shuffled.
Do not be displeased, Bao said to them. I know you went to great trouble to take some alive for me, but they would have made poor Inakal. They are not raised to it, and during this war we do not have time to train them. Killing them now is a mercy compared to what they would have had to endure. Besides, this Aes Sedai, will serve our purpose.
Lyanna's mask had cracked, and despite the distance, Egwene could see her hatred. Bao still had her chin cupped in his hand.
You are a beautiful thing, he said. Unfortunately, beauty is meaningless. You are to deliver a message for me, Aes Sedai, to Luz Theron, the one who calls himself the Dragon Reborn. Tell him that I have come to slay him, and in so doing, I will claim this world. I will take what originally should have been mine. Tell him that. Tell him you have seen me and describe me to him. He will know me. Just as the people here awaited him with prophecy, just as they showered him with glory, the people of my land awaited me. I have fulfilled their prophecies. He is false, and I am true. Tell him I will finally have satisfaction. He is to come to me so that we may face one another. If he does not, I will slaughter and destroy. I will seize his people. I will enslave his children. I will take his women for my own. One by one, I will break, destroy, or dominate everything he has loved. The only way for him to avoid this is for him to come and face me. Tell him this, little Aes Sedai. Tell him that an old friend awaits. I am Bao, the Willed, he who is owned only by the land, the Dragon Slayer. He knew me once by a name I have scorned, the name Barid Bel.
Barid Bel? Egwene thought, memories from her lessons in the White Tower returning to her. Barid Bel Maedar. Demon Dread.
The storm in the Wolf Dream was a changeable thing. Perrin spent hours prowling the borderlands, visiting packs of wolves as he ran down dry riverbeds and across broken hills. Gaul had learned quickly. He wouldn't stand for a moment against Slayer, of course, but at least he had learned to keep his clothing from changing, though his veil did still snap up to cover his face when he was startled. The two of them bounded through Kandor, leaving blurs in the air as they moved from hilltop to hilltop. The storm was sometimes strong, sometimes weak. At the moment, Kandor was hauntingly still. The grassy highland landscape was strewn with all kinds of debris. Tents, roofing tiles, the sail of a large ship, even a blacksmith's anvil, deposited point first into a muddy hillside. The dangerously powerful storm could arise anywhere in the Wolf Dream and rip apart cities or forests. He'd found Tyran hats blown all the way to Shinar. Perrin came to rest on a hilltop, Gaul streaking into place beside him. How long had they been searching for Slayer? A few hours, it seemed, on one hand. On the other, how much ground had they crossed? They had returned to their food stores now 3 times to eat. Did that mean a day had passed?
Gaul, Perrin said. How long have we been at this?
I cannot say, Perrin Ebarra, Gaul replied. He checked for the sun, though there was none.
A long while. Will we need to stop and sleep?
That was a good question. Perrin's stomach suddenly growled, and he made them a meal of dried meat and a hunk of bread. He gave some to Gaul. Would summoned bread sustain them in the Wolf Dream, or would it merely vanish once they consumed it? The latter. The food vanished even as Perrin ate it. They would need to rely upon their supplies, perhaps getting more from Rans Ashaman during the daily opening of their portal. For now, he shifted back to their packs and dug out some dried meat, then rejoined Gaul in the north. As they settled down on the hillside to eat again, he found himself dwelling on the dream spike. He carried it with him, turned to its slumbering position, as Lanfear had taught him. It made no dome now, but he could make one when he wished. Lanfear had all but given it to him. What did that mean? Why did she taunt him? He ripped at a hunk of dried meat. Was Fahil safe? If the shadow discovered what she was doing,
Well, he wished he could at least check on her. He took a long drink from his water skin, then searched outward for the wolves. There were hundreds of them up here in the borderlands, perhaps thousands. He gave those nearby a greeting, sending his scent mixed with his image. The dozen replies that came were not words, but his mind understood them as such. "Young bull," this from a wolf named White Eyes. "The last hunt is here. Will you lead us?" Many asked this lately, and Perrin couldn't figure out how to interpret it.
"Why do you need me to lead you?"
"It will be your call," White Eyes replied. "By your howl."
"I don't understand what you mean," Perrin said. "Can you not hunt on your own?" "Not this prey, young bull."
Perrin shook his head, a response like others he'd received.
"White Eyes," he sent, "have you seen Slayer, the killer of wolves? Has he stalked you here?"
Perrin sent it out broadly, and some of the other wolves replied. They knew of Slayer. His image and scent had been passed among many wolves, much as had Perrin's own. None had seen him recently, but time was an odd thing to wolves. Perrin wasn't certain how recent their recently really was. Perrin took a bite of dried meat and caught himself growling softly. He stifled that. He had come to a peace with the wolf inside of him, but that didn't mean he intended to let it start tracking mud into the house.
"Young bull," another wolf sent.
Turnbow, an aged female pack leader.
"Moon Hunter walks the dreams again. She seeks you." "Thank you," he sent back. "I know this. I will avoid her."
"Avoid the moon?" Turnbow sent back.
"A difficult thing, young bull."
"Difficult."
She had the right of that. "I saw Heartseeker just now," sent Steps, a black-furred youth. "She wears a new scent, but it is her."
Other wolves sent agreement. Heartseeker was in the wolf dream. Some had seen her to the east, but others said that she had been seen to the south. But what of Slayer? Where was the man, if not hunting wolves? Perrin caught himself growling again. Heartseeker. That must be one of the Forsaken, though he didn't recognize the images they sent of her. She was ancient, and so were the memories of wolves, but often the things they remembered were fragments of fragments that their ancestors had seen.
"Any news?" Gaul said.
"Another one of the Forsaken is here," Perrin said with a grunt, "doing something to the east."
"Does it involve us?"
"The Forsaken always involve us," Perrin said, standing.
He reached down, touched Gaul on the shoulder, and shifted them in the direction Steps had indicated. The position wasn't exact, but once Perrin arrived, he found some wolves who had seen Heartseeker on their way to the borderlands the day before. They sent Perrin eager greetings, asking if he was going to lead them. He rebuffed their questions, pinpointing where Heartseeker had been spotted. It was Marilor. Perrin shifted there. A strange mist hung over the landscape here. Tall trees, the ones Rand had grown, reflected here, and their lofty tops poked out of the mist above. Tents dotted the landscape like the tops of mushrooms. Aiel tents were plentiful, and between them cook fires glowed in the mist. This camp had been here long enough to manifest in the wolf dream, though tent flaps changed places and bedrolls vanished, flickering in the insubstantial way of this place. Perrin led Gaul between the neat rows of tents and horseless horse pickets. They both froze as they heard a sound. Someone muttering. Perrin used the trick he'd seen Lanfear use, creating a pocket of something around himself that was invisible, but which stopped sound. It was strange, but he did it by creating a barrier with no air in it. Why would that make the sound stop? He and Gaul crept forward to the canvas of a tent. That of the man Rodal Iteralda, one of the great captains, judging by the banner.
Inside, a woman in trousers picked through documents on a table. They kept vanishing in her fingers. Perrin didn't recognize her, though she was painfully homely. That certainly wasn't what he'd have expected from one of the Forsaken. Not that large forehead, bulbous nose, uneven eyes, or thinning hair. He didn't recognize her curses, though he grasped the meaning from her tone. Gaul looked at him, and Perrin reached for his hammer, but hesitated. Attacking Slayer was one thing, but one of the Forsaken? He was confident of his ability to resist Weaves here in the Wolf Dream, but still... The woman cursed again as the paper she was reading vanished. Then she looked up. Perrin's reaction was immediate. He created a paper-thin wall between her and him, her side painted with an exact replica of the landscape behind him, his side transparent. She looked right at him, but didn't see him, and turned away. Beside him, Gaul let out a very soft breath of relief.
"How did I do that?"
Perrin thought. It wasn't something he had practiced. It had merely seemed right. Heartseeker, this had to be she, waved her fingers, and the tent split in half above her, the canvas flaps hanging down. She rose through the air, moving toward the black tempest above. Perrin whispered to Gaul,
"Wait here, and watch for danger."
Gaul nodded. Perrin cautiously followed Heartseeker, lifting himself into the air with a thought. He tried to form another wall between himself and her, but it was too difficult to keep the right image displayed while moving. Instead, he kept his distance and put a blank, brownish-green wall between him and the Forsaken, hoping that if she happened to glance down, she'd pass over the small oddity. She began to move more quickly, and Perrin forced himself to keep up. He glanced down and was rewarded with the stomach-churning sight of Marilor's landscape dwindling below. Then it grew dark and vanished into blackness. They didn't pass through the clouds. As the ground faded away, so did the clouds, and they entered someplace black. Pinpricks of light appeared all around Perrin. The woman above stopped and hung in the air for a few moments before streaking away to the right. Perrin followed again, coloring himself, his skin, his clothing, everything, black to hide. The woman approached one of the pinpricks of light until it expanded and dominated the sky in front of her. Heartseeker reached her hands forward and pressed them against the light. She was muttering to herself. Feeling he needed to hear what she was saying, Perrin dared move closer, though he suspected that the pounding of his heart was so loud it would give him away.
"Take it from me," she said. "You think I care? Give me a face of broken stone. What do I care? That's not me. I will have your place, Moradin. It will be mine. This face will just make them underestimate me, burn you."
Perrin frowned. He couldn't make much sense of what she was saying.
"Go ahead and throw your armies at them, you fools," she continued to herself. "I'll have the greater victory. An insect can have 1,000 legs, but only 1 head. Destroy the head, and the day is yours. All you're doing is cutting off the legs, stupid fool! Stupid, arrogant, insufferable fool! I'll have what is due me. I'll..."
She hesitated, then pivoted. Perrin, spooked, immediately sent himself to the ground. It worked, thankfully. He hadn't known if it would up in that place of lights. Gaul jumped, and Perrin took a deep breath.
"Let's..."
A ball of blazing fire crashed into the ground beside him. Perrin cursed and rolled, cooling himself with a gust of wind, imagining his hammer up into his hand. Heartseeker dropped to the ground in a wave of energy, power rippling around her.
"Who are you?" she demanded. "Where are you? I..."
She focused suddenly on Perrin, seeing him completely for the first time, the blackness having faded from his clothing.
"You!" she screeched. "You are to blame for this!"
She raised her hands. Her eyes almost seemed to glow with hatred. Perrin could smell the emotion in spite of the blowing wind. She released a white-hot bar of light, but Perrin bent it around himself. The woman started.
They always did that. Didn't they realize that nothing was real here except what you thought to be real? Perrin vanished, appearing behind her, raising his hammer. Then he hesitated. A woman? She spun about, screaming and ripping the earth beneath him. He jumped up into the sky, and the air around him tried to seize him. But he did what he'd done before, creating a wall of nothingness. There was no air to grab him. Holding his breath, he vanished and appeared back on the ground, summoning banks of earth in front of him to block the balls of fire that hurtled his way.
"I want you dead," the woman screamed. "You should be dead. My plans were perfect."
Perrin vanished, leaving behind a statue of himself. He appeared beside the tent, where Gaul watched carefully, spear raised. Perrin put up a wall between them and the woman, coloring it to hide them, and made a barrier to block the sound.
"She can't hear us now," Perrin said.
"You are strong here," Gaul said thoughtfully.
"Very strong. Do the wise ones know of this?"
"I'm still a pup compared to them," Perrin said.
"Perhaps," Gaul said. "I have not seen them, and they do not speak of this place to men."
He shook his head.
"Much honor, Perrin Ebarra. You have much honor." "I should have just struck her down,"
Perrin said, as Heartseeker destroyed the statue of him, then stepped up to it, looking confused. She turned about, searching frantically.
"Yes," Gaul agreed. "A warrior who will not strike a maiden is a warrior who refuses her honor. Of course, the greater honor for you would be to take her captive."
Could he do it? Perrin took a breath, then sent himself behind her, imagining vines reaching around her to hold her in place. The woman howled curses at him, slicing the vines with unseen blades. She reached her hand toward Perrin, and he shifted to the side. His feet crunched on bits of frost on the ground that he hadn't noticed, and she immediately spun on him and released another weave of balefire. Clever, Perrin thought, barely managing to bend the light away. It struck the hillside behind, drilling a hole straight through it. Heartseeker continued the weave, snarling, hideous face distorted. The weave bent back toward Perrin, and he gritted his teeth, keeping it at bay.
She was strong.
She pushed hard, but finally she released it, panting.
How can you possibly...
Perrin filled her mouth with fork root. It was difficult to do. Changing anything directly about a person was always harder. However, this was much easier than trying to transform her into an animal or the like. She raised a hand to her mouth, eyes adopting a look of panic. She began to spit and hack, then desperately opened a gateway beside her. Perrin growled, imagining ropes reaching for her, but she destroyed them with a weave of fire. She must have gotten the fork root out. She hurled herself through the gateway, and he shifted himself to be right in front of it, preparing to leap through. He froze when he saw her entering the middle of an enormous army of Trollocs and Fades at night. Many faced the gateway, eager. Perrin stepped back as Heartseeker raised a hand to her mouth, looking aghast and coughing out more fork root. The gateway closed.
"You should have killed her,"
Lanfear said. Perrin turned to find the woman standing nearby, her arms folded. Her hair had changed from silver to dark brown. In fact, her face had changed, too, becoming slightly more like it had been before when he'd first seen her nearly 2 years ago. Perrin said nothing, returning his hammer to its straps.
"This is a weakness, Perrin,"
Lanfear said.
"I found it charming in Luce Theron at one point, but that doesn't make it any less a weakness. You need to overcome it."
"I will," he snapped. "What was she doing up there with the balls of light?"
"Invading dreams," Lanfear said. "She was here in the flesh. That affords one certain advantages, particularly when playing with dreams. That hussy. She thinks she knows this place, but it has always been mine. It would have been best if you'd killed her."
"That was Grendel, wasn't it?" Perrin asked. "Or was it Mogadine?" Grendel, Lanfear said. Though again, we are not to use that name for her. She's been renamed Hesalam.
Hesalam, Perrin said, trying the word out in his mouth.
I don't know it. It means without forgiveness.
And what is your new name? The one we're supposed to call you now? That actually pulled a blush out of her.
Never mind, she said. You are skilled here in Telairon Riad. Much better than Luce Theron ever was. I always thought I would rule at his side, that only a man who could channel would be worthy of me. But the power you display here, I think I may accept it as a substitute.
Perrin grunted. Gaul had moved across the small clearing between the camp tents, spear raised, Shufa covering his face. Perrin waved him off. Not only was Lanfear likely to be much better with the wolf dream than Gaul, but she hadn't done anything specifically threatening yet.
If you've been watching me, Perrin said, you'll know that I'm married, quite happily. So I have seen.
Then stop looking at me like a flank of beef hung up for display in the market, Perrin growled. What was Grendel doing here? What does she want?
I'm not certain, Lanfear said lightly. She always has three or four plots going at the same time. Don't underestimate her, Perrin. She's not as skilled here as some others, but she is dangerous. She's a fighter, unlike Mogadin, who will run from you whenever she can.
I'll keep that in mind, Perrin said, walking up to the place where she'd vanished by gateway. He prodded at the earth where the gateway had cut the ground.
You could do that, you know, Lanfear said.
He spun on her.
What? Go back and forth into the waking world, she said, without requiring the help of one like Luce Theron.
Perrin didn't like the way she sneered when she said his name. She tried to cover it up, but he smelled hatred on her whenever she mentioned him.
I can't channel, Perrin said. I suppose I could imagine being able to. It wouldn't work, she said. There are limits to what one can accomplish here, regardless of how strong the mind. The ability to channel is not a thing of the body, but a thing of the soul. There are still ways for one such as you to move back and forth between worlds in the flesh. The one you call Slayer does it.
He's not a wolf, brother.
No, she said. But he is something similar. I'm honestly not certain another has had his skills before. The Dark One did something to this Slayer when capturing his soul, or his souls. I suspect Semirag might have been able to tell us more. It's a pity she's dead.
Lanfear didn't smell of pity at all. She glanced at the sky, but was calm, not worried.
You don't seem as worried about being spotted as you once were, Perrin noted. My former master is occupied. This last week, watching you, I've rarely felt his eyes on me.
Weak? Perrin asked, shocked. But
time passes oddly here, she said, and the barriers of time itself are fraying. The closer you are to the boar, the more time will distort. For those who approach Shael Ghul in the real world, it will be just as bad. For every day that passes to them, three or four might pass to those more distant.
A week? Light. How much had happened on the outside? Who lived and who had died while Perrin hunted? He should wait at the traveling ground for his portal to open. But judging by the darkness he'd seen through Grendel's gateway, it was night. Perrin's escape portal could be hours away.
You could make a gateway for me, Perrin said. A pathway out, then back in. Will you?
Lanfear considered it, strolling past one of the flickering tents and letting her fingers trail on the canvas as it vanished.
No,
she finally said.
But you must learn to do this thing for yourself if we are to be together.
We're not going to be together, he said flatly.
You need this power of and for yourself, she said, ignoring what he had said. You are weak so long as you are trapped only in one of the worlds. Being able to come here when you want will give you great power.
I don't care about power, Lanfear, he said, watching her as she continued to stroll. She was pretty. Not as pretty as Fael, of course. Beautiful, nonetheless.
Don't you? She faced him. Have you never thought of what you could do with more strength, more power, more authority?
That won't tempt me to.
Save lives, she said. Prevent children from starving. Stop the weak from being bullied. End wickedness. Reward honor. Power to encourage men to be straightforward and honest with one another.
He shook his head.
You could do so much good, Baron Ibarra, she said, walking up to him, then touching the side of his face, running her fingers down his beard.
Tell me how to do what Slayer does, Baron said, pushing her hand away. How does he move between worlds?
I cannot explain it to you, she said, turning away. As it is a skill I have never had to learn. I use other methods. Perhaps you can beat it out of him. I would be quick, assuming you wish to stop Grendel.
Stop her, Perrin said.
Didn't you realize? Lanfear turned back to him. The dream she was invading was not one of the people from this camp. Space and distance matter not to dreams. That dream you saw her invading, it belongs to Davram Bashir, father of your wife.
With that, Lanfear vanished.